would like to remind all parties the call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. And thank you. You may begin.
Thanks very much. Okay, welcome to the, what month is this? August. Charm Telecon, and we're joined today by Matthew Hedman. And Matt's a researcher at Cornell University. I always make the snafu of not saying doctor, so I should say Dr. Matthew Hedman. And he's at Cornell in Ithaca, New York. And Matt's a ring scientist working with both VIMS and imaging data on Cassini. And he's published a large number of papers on Saturn's rings, both the dense ring and the faint ring, and phenomena that shape the rings. And when I was doing a little bit of research into Matt's background, it's always fascinating to do that. So he's got a website at Cornell, and he actually has a background in both physics and anthropology and publishes papers outside of physics, and maybe we can get him to tell us a little bit about that at the end of his lecture. And he has also authored a book. It's called The Age of Everything, How Science Explores the Past. And it focuses on how scientists determine when things have happened in ancient history. And I know I'm going to spend a little bit of time. He's got some lecture notes and supporting material on his website, so I'm going to spend some time looking at that. For today, however, he's going to talk about the phenomena that produce the interesting features in Saturn's rings, and the title of his talk is The Forces That Sculpt Saturn's Rings. So, Matt?
Okay, thank you for that nice introduction. Can you all hear me okay?
Yeah.
I sure can.
Yes.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. So I trust everyone has the presentation in front of them. Basically, in this talk, I've got a couple of points where I'll break to ask for questions, since it's kind of hard to tell when somebody wants to ask a question. So there'll be like two or three times that I'll stop and ask for questions. So
yeah.
Hopefully that'll work out.
That would be great. And obsessively say what page you're on, if you would.
Yes, I'll try and say that.
Thanks.
Okay. So today I wanted to talk to you guys about the forces that sculpt Saturn's rings, that is, the processes responsible for producing all of the detailed structure in Saturn's rings. You know, Saturn's rings contain sharp edges, nearly empty gaps, and more subtle density variations. And it's a challenge to understand how these forces exist, how these features exist, and what produces them. Now, at the outset, you have to remember that the rings are composed of many small particles in orbit around the planet, as shown in this artist conception on slide 2. This means that any feature we see in Saturn's rings is not a structure in a solid object. It actually represents the coordinated motion of many, many individual ring particles. And a fundamental question of ring science is, how do so many ring particles get so organized? Now, if you go on to slide 3, there are two kind of basic processes by which ring material can get organized. The first is basically interactions between the ring particles themselves. The way the particles jostle against each other, and indeed their gravitational interactions, can actually produce some amount of structure. Now, the ones we understand the best are very small-scale features, such as the self-gravity wakes in Saturn's A ring, which are only tens of meters across. Now, I'll remind you, the entire span of the rings is like 50,000 kilometers across. So these are very small-scale features. Some people have speculated that larger scale structures could be produced by simple particle-particle interactions, but that remains rather speculative at this point, so I'm not going to talk much about that. Instead, what I'm going to focus on are the features in the rings that seem to be produced by outside forces. Basically, outside forces are pushing the particles in the rings around and producing various structures. Okay, with that introduction, go on to slide 4, which gives you an overview of the talk and also an overview of the ring system. Probably most of you know this. I just have labeled all the rings for convenience on this very nice image where we're looking at Saturn in eclipse. The A, B, and C rings are the dense main rings of Saturn, which, you know, you can see through a telescope here, a relatively small telescope here on Earth. While the D, E, F, and G rings are dusty faint rings that are typically harder to see, although they show up nicely in this image. And I'm going to talk about both features in both of these different types of rings. Now, this talk is basically broken into two parts. In the first part, which will take about the first two-thirds of the talk or so, I'm going to talk about how the gravitational tugs from Saturn's various moons can produce structures in the rings. This is the best understood process whereby outside forces produce structure in the rings. It's been known ever since the Voyager spacecraft flew by Saturn that the moons can produce structures in the rings. And so we have a mature theory that, you know, I think is worth going over. And it's kind of the basis for which we have to, basis on which we understand other forces perturbing the rings. And that's what the second part of the talk is going to be. The second part of the talk is going to be about some new discoveries we've made with the Vikings spacecraft that shows that other forces could be sculpting the rings. This includes gravitational tugs from other rings, like a feature in a ring could be produced by gravitational tugs from other rings. There are some features that seem to be produced by electromagnetic forces from Saturn's magnetosphere. And there are even some forces in the rings that seem to be affected by sunlight. Now, I put little question marks on these because our interpretation of these features is certain to at least be adjusted and refined as we get more and more data, because these are just kind of new insights in the rings. So, that being said, let's go on and consider how the Saturn's various moons can sculpt the rings. And so if you go on to slide 5, what you'll see is a nice picture of Saturn, its rings, and a couple moons. And it turns out the moons are really good at sculpting the rings. They produce all sorts of features like sharp edges, density variations, vertical warps, and even arcs. And it's actually maybe a little surprising that these moons can have such a big effect on the structure of the rings, given they're so tiny, as you can see in this image. The moons are way smaller than Saturn, and their gravitational forces are correspondingly feeble. So it might be a little surprising that the moons can do so much to the rings, but it turns out there are two conditions in which the moons can actually have a pretty big effect on the rings. The first condition is the moon just happens to be really close to the rings, and the second condition is if the ring material happens to occupy a resonance with the moon. Now, if you go on to slide 6, you will see an image of the outer part of Saturn's A ring that shows features that are produced by both of these sorts of situations. We can first look at features that are produced by moons that just happen to be very close to the ring. In this outer part of the A ring, there are actually two moons embedded inside the rings. They're labeled Pan and Daphnis. These moons orbit within narrow gaps in the rings, known as the Encke Gap and the Keeler Gap. Now, for scale, the Encke Gap's about 300 kilometers across. And basically, what these moons are actually producing, these gaps, they're actually holding the gap open and keeping material from drifting too close to the orbit of the moon. And if you actually look right around Daphnis, you'll see little wiggles on the edges. Those are actually a result of the gravitational tugs from the moon on the nearby ring material. Now, these interactions between nearby moons and rings has been discussed in previous CHARMM telecons by Dr. Murray and Dr. Weiss, so I'm not going to go too much into detail on this. What I'd rather focus on are the other features in this image that are produced by Saturn's moons, which are highlighted on slide 7. This includes these various bright streaks you see throughout the rings, one of which is marked as a density wave in this image. The other is the outer edge of the A ring, which is also produced by an interaction with one of Saturn's moons. But these features are not produced by interactions with nearby moons, like Pan or Daphnis, which are in this frame. They're produced by more distant moons, like Janus or Mimas, which are over 10,000 kilometers away. And Mimas's case, tens of thousands of miles. And so it might be somewhat surprising that such distant moons can produce such compact features in the rings. I mean, note how crisp the outer edge of the A ring is, and that this density wave, this bright streak that is the density wave, is a fairly compact feature in radius, in the radial direction. So it turns out that the reason that the moon is able to produce such localized structures in the rings is because these particular parts of the rings are in resonances with the moon. And what I mean by a resonance is simply that the orbital period of particles in the rings, that is how long they take to go around the planet, that orbital period is a whole number ratio times the orbital period of one of Saturn's moons. For example, at the outer edge of the A ring, the orbital period of ring particles is almost exactly 6/7 the orbital period of Janus, one of Saturn's moons. Now, you know, it's all well and good to say that these things are in a resonance and thus the moon is doing something, but what's actually the physical mechanism that's allowing the moons to have this sort of effect? To better understand that, I think it's useful to consider a cartoon example, which I start off with on slide 8. This is a simple cartoon picture of Saturn, its rings, and one moon. The moon is shown in blue, the rings are shown in gray, and I have one of the ring particles highlighted. At first, we're going to have the moon and the ring particle moving on nice circular orbits marked by the dashed lines, and the arrows indicate the direction of motion. Now, the important thing to remember is particles closer to the center of Saturn travel faster in their orbits than objects further away. This is just Kepler's laws. It's the same reason, you know, that Mercury moves around the planet, moves around the sun faster than, say, Neptune does. What's important about that is that it means every so often the particle passes by the moon as it's traveling around its orbit. And when it does that, it gets as close to the moon as it ever gets. That configuration is shown on slide 9. Now, when the particle is as close to the moon as it ever gets, it feels a little extra tug of gravity towards the moon. That's indicated by the green arrow on slide 9. That slight extra tug is going to change the trajectory of the particle. It's basically going to change its orbit a little bit. And so instead of following the dashed circular orbit, it's going to follow this slightly distorted elliptical orbit. Now, of course, in reality, the distortion produced by this slight extra tug is actually going to be really, really small and basically undetectable. I've exaggerated it here for clarity. And after the particle passes by the moon, it'll follow that new trajectory until it encounters the moon again. Now, for most particles in the rings, or at least many particles in the rings, the particle will encounter the moon at all sorts of random times around its orbit. And that means the orbit, every passage basically stretches and pushes the orbit in a different direction. And on average, all of those kind of perturbations more or less wash out and don't add up to much. And so the moon really doesn't have much effect. But if the orbital period of the ring particle is a whole number ratio times the orbital period of the moon, then something different can happen. So let's consider the simple, again, a very simplified case. We're going to imagine a case where the particle has an orbital period of 4 days and the moon has an orbital period of 8 days. This is just marked on slide 10. This just means that there's a so the orbital period of the particle is exactly one half the orbital period of the moon. Now, I'll just say the exact number of days is just artificial, just so we had nice round numbers to work with. So this doesn't correspond particularly to any particular ring or moon around Saturn, but it's just an illustrative example. Now, so if the particle has an orbital period of 4 days, the moon has an orbital period of 8 days, the particle has just passed by the moon and has its orbit distorted for the first time. Then we can ask, how do the particle and moon move over the next few days? That situation is shown on slide 11, which is a little bit busy, but it basically just shows the motion of the moon around the planet. You can see it goes around the planet once in 8 days. No surprise. The ring particle, of course, goes around the planet twice over the course of the next 8 days. So you can, if you look carefully, it goes from 0 days, 1 days, 2 days, 3 days. So it basically goes around twice in the same time the moon goes around once. So we call this a 2-to-1 resonance. The particle goes around twice for every one time the moon goes around. Now, what's important to realize is the particle first gets ahead of the moon and then catches back up with it. But it catches up to the moon 8 days after its first encounter. And what's really important is that the particle and the moon are in the same configuration at 8 days as they were at 0 days. That means the second time the particle passes the moon, it's in the same point in its orbit as it was when it passed the moon the previous time. This is illustrated on slide 12. So when the particle, again, feels this little extra gravitational tug towards the moon, that tugs in the same direction, and it's applied to the particle when it's in the same position as it was last time. So whatever sort of distortion this moon's gravity did to the orbit the first time, it's going to do it again. So instead of washing out, these small changes in the trajectory of the particle can actually grow over time and become more and more significant. So, and the reason this is possible is because there's this whole number ratio. That whole number ratio ensures the particle gets, that at least some of the times the particle is in the same position in its orbit when it gets yanked on by the moon. Now, this case was the simplest case, where you had a 2-to-1 ratio. You can also, it works, though, for any whole number ratio. It could have been 4-to-3, 5-to-8, 44-to-43. The higher you tend to make the numbers, the weaker the resonance gets, because the more times, more time that's needed is needed before you can get enough encounters to build up a distortion. So, for example, a 123rd to 425 resonance doesn't do as much as, say, a 3-to-2 or a 2-to-1. Now, so this sort of whole number ratio allows for the moon's perturbations to actually affect the rings, but it also creates a very localized structure. Because remember, particles will, it requires the particle to be moving in a with a proper period. And the particles, the time it takes the particle to move around a planet depends on how far it is from the planet. So, for example, if the particle is too far from the planet, it'll be moving too slowly and won't be in this resonance. If the particle is too close to the planet, it'll be moving too fast to be in this resonance. So it's only if the particle is a certain distance from the planet that it'll be in a resonance and that the moon will be able to significantly perturb its orbit. And, in fact, given what we know about Saturn's gravitational field and also given that we know the orbital periods of all of the various moons, we can actually calculate where these various resonances should occur in the rings and see if there are interesting features in the rings at those locations. Now, if you go on to slide 13, we, of course, find that there are many features in the rings that are at resonant locations. The most dramatic are the outer edges of the A ring and the B ring. This is just a nice picture of Saturn with the A and B ring marked, and it turns out the outer edges of both of these rings, which are the most massive of Saturn's rings, occur near strong resonances. The outer edge of the B ring occurs where a ring particle orbital period is exactly one, is about one-half the orbital period of Mimas. The outer edge of the A ring occurs where a ring particle orbital period is about 6/7 the orbital period of Janus. Again, these are two of Saturn's well-known moons. Now, that's, of course, a striking coincidence that suggests that these edges are being affected by the resonance, but we can actually demonstrate that the resonance is being involved, and this isn't just a numerical coincidence. And we can demonstrate that by looking more closely at the edges. For example, if you look at slide 14, we have a couple of images here from the Voyager spacecraft. Cassini has seen similar images but hasn't produced quite such a nice composite picture yet. What you see is it's the outer part of the B-ring, and the B-ring edge is marked. I first want to draw your attention to the features on the right-hand side of the image. On the right-hand side, you can see a whole bunch of relatively sharp features in the rings, and you can see they line up fairly well between the two images. But the edge of the B-ring clearly does not line up. This is not an artifact of how, you know, of projection or anything like that. This is a real effect. The position of the B-ring edge varies back and forth by as much as a couple hundred kilometers, depending on when and where you look. This has been seen now abundantly also by the Cassini spacecraft in images and also in many other data sets. So this is a real effect. And these variations in the position of the B-ring edge and are not random. They are patterned and have structure in them. And there's actually a couple different patterns on the B-ring edge, but one of the most prominent ones is clearly tied to Mimas. Remember, the B-ring edge is supposed to be in this 2-to-1 resonance with Mimas, or near this 2-to-1 resonance with Mimas. And if you go on to slide 15, you'll see a cartoon version of what that pattern is on that edge. I show basically a cartoon representation of this particular pattern on the B-ring edge and a similar pattern on the A-ring edge. I've here highly exaggerated these particular edge distortions just to make them visible in this cartoon. In practice, we would be talking about a variation of 100 kilometers out of 100,000 kilometers, and that would be hard to see. But this component of the B-ring edge forms a two-lobe shape, which is what you see as the inner gray disk. It's got a two-lobe shape, and that shape doesn't rotate at the local orbital speed. It doesn't rotate at the local orbital period. Instead, it tracks Mimas, so that the short axis of this pattern always points at Mimas. Similarly, the outer edge of the A ring has a strange seven-lobed pattern, and one of the short axes of that pattern always tracks Janus. Now, you can see that the shapes of these patterns kind of reflect the resonances we're talking about, too, as well. So, you know, the B-ring edge has a two-lobe shape, and it's material near a 2-to-1 resonance. The A-ring edge has a seven-lobe shape, and that is material that's near a 7-to-6 resonance. So this is strong evidence that the interactions with these moons are really affecting the rings in some way. And in fact, if you go through the hairy math of actually calculating these gravitational perturbations, you find that these moons can, in fact, shepherd these edges. They're actually probably responsible for keeping the material from drifting outwards and keeping that nice sharp edge in place. Now, one thing I do want to clarify about this, because I think people have seen these sorts of images, know that these edges may be distorted somewhat by these moons, but I want to make it clear that these patterns on these edges are just that, they're patterns. It's not as if the particles on the edges are actually moving around in seven-lobed or two-lobed shapes. All the particles on the edges are moving in and out on simple elliptical orbits. They're simply doing so in such an organized way that the edge looks like it has a two-lobed shape. To get a sense of that, look at slide 16, where I'm looking at the B-ring edge again, and I've basically color-coded four particles, red, green, yellow, and blue. Now, I've also drawn their orbits in the corresponding colors. The red and blue particles are as far from the planet as they ever get. The yellow and green particles are as close to the planet as they ever get. And if you draw a line through the four of them, you get this two-lobed pattern. Now, we can ask, what happens after these particles have completed half an orbit? Well, that configuration is shown on slide 17. In that case, now the red and blue particles have gotten closer to the planet, the yellow and green particles have gotten further from the planet. And so you still have this two-lobe shape, but the two-lobe shape has rotated, but it hasn't rotated by 180 degrees, it's only rotated by 90 degrees. It's only rotated half as far as the individual particles have. And furthermore, that shape has maintained a fixed orientation with respect to Mimas, because Mimas has also only moved through 90 degrees, because, remember, we're in a 2-to-1 resonance. Mimas goes around the planet once for every 2 times the particle goes around. So it makes sense. The particles have gone around 180 degrees, Mimas has moved 90 degrees, so this pattern maintains a lock with Mimas. And so this is just an example of how, you know, these patterns induced by, for example, moons can produce structures in the rings that, you know, basically betray their origin and tell us where to look for what sort of gravitational forces might be producing them. So next up, I want to talk about the different kinds of resonances, but given this is the first 20 minutes, I figured I would break and just ask if anyone had any questions about this first part of the talk, which was just kind of a review of basic resonance physics. Nope.
Sounds like not. Those are really good graphics, though, Matt. Describe that.
Okay.
I think that's what you need, because it's a little bit tricky.
Might steal them from my upcoming Saturn talk in a couple of months.
Who was that?
Jason Kendall in New York City.
Okay, great.
Doing so.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
I have a question.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Are the effects on the rings of these resonances, are they stable over a long period of time? Will things drift away, or is there something that keeps it oscillatory so that it never will drift out or go to pieces?
Let's say that, it is stable for a long period of time. We've seen the same resonant features from Cassini and from Voyager, so it's not as if they happen quickly. For example, you could imagine that these perturbations would build up to such an extent that the particle would go into a highly elliptical orbit and be thrown out of the system. That, in practice, doesn't happen very often because other things come into case and make and keep the system relatively stable. But trying to understand all of the interactions between the various systems is a little bit of a tricky bit. And in some cases, the stability of these systems is a little bit... maybe not questionable, but difficult to quantify. Is that maybe answering your question a little bit?
Yeah, I think you did, yeah. I just think a lot of times in terms of resonances, just like in a bridge or something like that, where energy is constantly going into the system in a very easy way, that it could basically become unstable.
Yes. Okay, well, the critical thing here is, yes, if these were what happens in the main rings, and you're right about that, in principle, you could push on the ring particles so hard that they could get very highly eccentric and, you know, bit almost ejected from Saturn in principle. I don't think that can practically happen. But there is something here that acts sort of like a dissipation. The idea is basically, and that actually leads kind of nicely into the next slide. The thing is, what the moon perturbations can do in this particular case, for example, is it can pull material, it's causing material to move from circular orbits to particles that to orbits that move alternately closer and further from the center of the planet. Those particles are going to basically start running into other ring particles. And those collisions are going to dissipate the energy and similar and basically allow the thing to keep from falling apart, like the Tacoma Narrow Bridge did.
Right.
So there are mechanisms that keep the system from just going completely out of control that are different in different situations.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay. That's kind of my arm-waving explanation. It's, of course, a little tricky because this is gravity.
Right.
Okay.
Another quick question?
Yep.
Looking at these slides, they look oddly tidal. Would it be oversimplifying things to compare this to our own lunar tides?
Let's see. It would. I'm trying to think. The thing is, for example, lunar. I think it's a similar thing in the sense of the moon is pulling on things. I have a question. I am not familiar enough with. The trick is here. We have the orbital period of the moon and the orbital period of the ring particle. We have two time periods, and we want those to be a whole number ratio. The question when we were talking about lunar tides on, say, Earth. We have the orbital period of the moon, and then we have kind of the sloshing response function of, say, the oceans or the rock of the Earth. And that's not quite the same situation, I would say.
Both are moving in the case of Saturn, and only one is moving in the case of our lunar tides.
Right, right. Well, you could imagine ways, for example, here's an important point. If you have lunar tides and you bring it to the point where, say, the spin period of the Earth was the same as the lunar orbital period, then that's the case where you kind of have these sorts of resonances. And, you know, that's actually what tends to happen. Things tend to get locked into those kind of states. So that is a case. There are similar cases like that. I'm not sure I would make the direct analogy to this sort of situation. Because here we're talking about two orbital periods versus, say, an orbital period and a spin period. So it's slightly different, but related things can occur, I believe.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, just to say, there is one example. For example, if you have something in a resonance that's rotating, you can actually cause the thing to tumble. For example, there are some moons like Hyperion, which are chaotically tumbling in part because they rotate because of torques applied to the rotation state of the moon. But that's, again, a slightly different situation. Okay? Okay, so moving on to the different types of resonances. The type of resonances we're talking about thus far is where the particles move in and out. This occurs at something we call a Lindblad resonance. And these are responsible both for producing sharp ring edges, but they also produce density variations in the rings, simply because they cause ring particles to move alternately closer and further to the center of the planet. That causes material to get alternately packed together and spread apart. And that perturbation in the local density can actually propagate through the rings in the form of density waves. If you go on to slide 19, my apologies, you can see a couple examples of these density waves in this real close-up image of the rings taken by the cameras on board Cassini. And what you see are several periodic features with alternating bright and dark bands. Those variations in the brightness of the rings reflect variations in density. And each one of these features can be associated with a Lindblad resonance. The feature at the left occurs where the ring particle orbital period is about 5/6 the orbital period of Janus. The middle one occurs where the ring particle orbital period is about 12/13 the orbital period of Pandora, and so forth and so on. Now, you know, you can notice the feature associated with Janus is a lot bigger than the feature associated with Pandora. That's mainly because Janus has just got a lot more mass and can push the ring material around a lot more. Now, you don't have to be really close to the rings to see these features. You can see some of them from quite a distance away, as shown on slide 20, which shows a picture of the outer part of the A ring, or actually shows the entire A ring, and I've highlighted a few bright features in this ring, each of which is associated with a resonance. They're basically different whole number ratios times, they're where the ring particles have orbital periods that are whole number ratio times Janus's orbital period. And these are particularly strong resonances where the particles are being probably jostled around enough to basically change their light scattering properties. Basically, particles are either being just being packed together in a different way, or maybe their surfaces are getting roughed up by the collisions. That's still work in progress. And if you look at slide 21, that's just a close-up showing many, many dark bands. Each one of those can be associated with a resonance. But not all of these features are due to Lindblad resonances. For example, if you look at slide 22, you will see another close-up image of the rings with two structures in it. The structure at the lower right looks like the Lindblad resonance associated density waves we saw in a couple of slides ago. And indeed, that's probably what it is. The feature at the upper right has a similar kind of look. It, again, looks like alternating bright and dark bands, but it just looks kind of different. The bright and dark bands kind of are arranged in a slightly different way. This is because this is not a density feature. This is what's known as a bending wave. It's actually a vertical feature. The difference in brightness here are not due to differences in density, it's due to differences in the slope of the ring that's affecting how it catches the light. And what's happening here is a vertical distortion of the ring that's being produced by something called a vertical resonance, which is described on slide 23. These sorts of resonances can occur if the moon is on an orbit that's slightly tilted out of Saturn's equator plane. That is, it's tilted relative to the ring plane, which is seen more clearly in the bottom image. Now, if the moon's orbit's tilted in this way, you can not only pull the ring particles back and forth and in and out, you can in principle pull them up and down. And when you're in a resonance, you can pull them significantly out of the ring plane, which is what sets up a bending wave. Now, if Saturn were a perfect sphere and the rings were completely massless, this vertical resonance would occur in the same point of the rings as the Lindblad resonance. But in reality, Saturn's slightly flattened. It's basically flattened. It's oblate. It's not as wide pole to pole as it is around the equator. And that distorts Saturn's gravity field a little bit and causes something called resonance splitting. It basically means that for a particle on a tilted orbit, it takes more time for a particle on a tilted orbit to go up and down above the ring plane than it takes a particle on an elliptical orbit to move in and out towards the center of Saturn. And what that does is it actually separates the positions of the vertical resonance and the Lindblad resonance. This is illustrated on slide 24, where we see another couple of images of the outer part of Saturn's A ring, centered on this nice moon, Pan, in the Encke Gap. But the feature I really want to draw your attention to are at the bottom of the image. I've marked something called the Mimas 5-3 density wave and the Mimas 5-3 bending wave. both of these are 5-3 resonances with Mimas. Ring particles go around about 5 times for every 3 times Mimas goes around. But what's special about this, what's different about these, is the density wave occurs at the location of the Lindblad resonance, and the bending wave occurs at the position of the vertical resonance. Now, if you look at the right-hand image marked other times, those two features don't look all that different, and you might wonder if there really any significant difference between them. They both look like kind of bright streaks. But if you look at the left-hand image marked near equinox, you can see that they look quite different. The density wave looks about the same in both images, but the bending wave now looks like a bright streak with a dark band next to it. This actually makes sense given what's special about the left-hand image. It was taken around equinox. It was taken at a time when the sun was illuminating the rings from almost exactly edge-on, and so we got lots of shots of neat shadows being cast upon the rings. For example, you can see the shadow of Pan being cast across the rings in the center of the image. Now, the density wave, that's back-and-forth motion. That's motion in the ring plane. That shouldn't do much in terms of shadows. And indeed, that feature looks pretty much the same in both images. But the bending wave, that's supposed to be a vertical distortion in the rings. That can cast shadows. And in fact, that dark band is in the right place, you can compare it to the shadow of Pan, to be the shadow of the wave. So this sort of image confirms that bending wave is indeed a vertical distortion in the rings. Okay, the last type of resonance I want to mention is discussed on slide 25. This is known as a co-rotation resonance. This type of resonance can occur when the moon is on an elliptical orbit. The moon itself actually alternately gets closer and further from the center of the planet. Now, when this happens, the moon is able to basically tug particles in the ring back and forth in a way it couldn't if it was on a purely circular orbit. And this allows for the formation of what are known as ring arcs. Now, what's a ring arc? Well, an example of a ring arc shown on slide 26. This shows an image, the upper part shows a context image pointing at the G ring. The G ring is a faint ring of Saturn that lives outside the main rings and contains one of the nicer examples of an incomplete ring arc. The four images at the bottom show four images of the ring arc, where we basically, all we did was we stared at one part of the G-ring and watched material rotate through. And what we saw was this bright arc of material move along the inner edge of the ring. If you're having trouble seeing it, the center of it's pointed to by those two white arrows. Now, this thing is an incomplete feature in the rings, and that's somewhat surprising, because it's got a finite width. Remember, depending on how close you are to the center of the planet, that affects how fast you move around the planet. So you'd expect particles on the outer part of this feature to move slower than the particles on the inner part of this feature, and so this bright thing should shear out and eventually form a complete ring. But that's not what we see. We've seen this feature for over, I think, 6 years now, and it's always been this relatively compact structure that only extends about 30 to 60 degrees around the planet. So something must be keeping this thing confined. And the question, what is that? Well, we took a lot of images to try and figure out what was going on here. If you go on to slide 27, you'll see one unexpected benefit of taking all these images of this arc. We actually found a tiny moon embedded in this arc. Slide 27 shows a couple images of the G-ring arc, and we have a couple little arrows pointed to a tiny little streak in the middle of the ring. That little streak is a tiny moon. It's officially now known as Agion, and it's roughly a kilometer across. It is the smallest isolated moon of Saturn yet found, and we would have had a hard time finding something this small if we weren't spending a lot of time looking at this arc. Anyway, but the other advantage of having all of these images is we could confirm that this arc went around the planet 7 times every time Mimas went around 6. So there seemed to be a 7-6 resonance involved. And what we eventually figured out was that it was a co-rotation resonance that was actually confining the material in this arc. Now, how does that work? Well, to see how that works, look at the cartoon on slide 28. This shows the moon, the arc on its orbit, and the Mimas on its orbit. Note I've highly exaggerated the ellipticity of Mimas' orbit. just for clarity. Now, this is what the system would look like from above if we were just hovering above this thing. But what if we were actually, say, standing on Agion? How would the trajectory of Mimas look in that sort of reference? Well, Mimas will still have to move alternately closer and further through the center of the planet, but because we're rotating around, because we're revolving around the planet with Agion and the material in the arc, it's not going to move on this simple elliptical path anymore. It's instead going to move on a funky six-lobe path shown on slide 29. And the reason it's a six-lobe path is because the arc goes around the planet seven times for every six times Mimas goes around. And you can imagine as Mimas moves around this six-lobe path, it basically carves out six pockets in space where material can be stably trapped. Basically, its gravitational tugs will do that. And the arc actually occupies one of these six pockets. Now, furthermore, the arc is only about 30 to 60 degrees across, depending on how you measure it. And that fits nicely within one of these pockets. So this, again, the shape of this feature, you know, confirms our ideas that there are these tugs from these moons that are producing, that are responsible for these features. The next couple of slides show further examples of other ring arcs produced by resonances with moons. The first evidence that a resonance with a moon might produce a ring arc was actually found at Neptune by Voyager. There, Voyager saw these arcs in the Adams ring, which you see on slide 30. These arcs are believed to be confined by 42 to 43 resonances with Neptune's moon Galatea. We also now have a couple more examples of ring arcs around Saturn even. These are shown on slide 31, which shows a couple of images of two small moons of Saturn, Ancy and Mesone. These are moons that are only a couple kilometers across. And in this image, you can actually see bright arcs of material surrounding both moons. Again, these are incomplete rings, and it turns out both of these arcs are, again, confined by co-rotation resonances with Mimas. So we can see there are many examples where moons are affecting the rings, but there are also cases where other forces seem to be affecting the rings, and that's what I'm going to talk about next. But again, I think it's probably a useful time to stop and ask if there are any questions about these different kinds of resonances.
Any questions out there?
I've got one. This is Tish from Copernic. Matthew, there's so many numbers and variables involved here. You must have had a lot of fun with these numbers. But you didn't mention the mass and the distance of the moons. Do you think that that makes a big difference?
Both of those do affect what's the strength of the resonance. So if the moon is further away, it has less effect on the rings. And if the moon is less massive, it has less effect on the rings. Even at these resonances, those parameters still come into play.
Okay.
So yes, the resonances allow for localized effects, but the strength of these effects does still depend on the distance to the moons and the mass of the moons.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
What were your qualifications for determining that Agion was indeed a moon rather than just a very large ring particle?
We are getting into the question of whether Agion's a very big ring particle or a moon. As far as I am aware, the International Astronomical Union has not officially defined what's a moon versus a big ring particle. The defining characteristic of Agion is it's an individual object we can track. And that is as opposed to when we look at the rings in general, what we see is a lot of ring particles and we can't distinguish individual ones. So that's our basis for comparing, for saying Agion's a moon. But I could actually see in the future, you know, people say, well, you know, there's particles in the rings that might be that big. Do we call this a moon or do we call this a ring particle? But basically, it's an individual identifiable object. We can track where it is and we can predict where it's going to be in the future.
Is that more helpful than, for example, just taking images of the ring arc as a composite of bright particles?
They give you different information. Since you can precisely see where the moon is, you can actually see the particle moving back and forth along its. You can actually see more how its how the orbit of that individual particle is being affected by the perturbation, the gravitational tugs from Mimas. So, in that sense, that's a big advantage. But the overall size and shape of the arc also can tell us more about the overall properties of this resonance, and can also allow us, you know, to begin to see, you know, how smaller particles might be affected as opposed to, like, the big particle that is Agion. So they kind of give us independent information about that. And in principle, the response of the, in principle, in the case of, like, say, the arcs associated with Anthea and Nathone, you could potentially see the arc responding to the gravity of the moon that's embedded within it.
Right.
And that could tell you something about, you know, the mass of the moon, which would be very tricky to get otherwise.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions for Matt?
Are we good?
Yeah, I think.
Okay, so let's go on to the weird stuff. So like I said, there's a lot of structure in the rings that can produce by that's produced by the gravitational tugs from moons. In fact, a lot of the structure, especially in the A ring, can be explained in terms of moons. But there's a lot of features in Saturn's rings that are not near any strong resonance, or they just don't have the right shape, orientation, or movement to make sense given a resonance with any particular moon. And so, what we've been trying to do is figure out what's the origin of these structures. Now, we can kind of take the same logic we were applying before and apply it to some of these strange features in the rings and see if we can figure out what forces may be producing them. In particular, if we can figure out the shape, the orientation, and the motion of some unexplained ring feature, that can often give us some clues as to what forces might be acting on the ring particles in this region. And using that sort of logic, we've been able to find structures in the rings that could be affected by sunlight, some features in the rings that could be affected by electromagnetic forces in Saturn's magnetosphere, and even some features in the rings that are that might be affected by gravitational tugs from non-circular ring features. Now, again, these are very much in-progress analysis things that, you know, our interpretation may somewhat change as more and more data becomes analyzed. Now, I figured I would start with perhaps the one that's most surprising, that there are features in the rings that are affected by sunlight. Because perhaps counterintuitively, that's the one where we actually understand the physics the best. And you might be surprised that the sun that sunlight can affect the rings. I mean, Saturn is pretty far from the sun. Now, it's true for the main rings, for the rings you see on slide 32, for example. The particles that you're seeing there, those really aren't affected much by sunlight. They're big particles. They range in size from, say, pebbles to boulders, maybe even to the size of houses, and sometimes bigger. Such big ring particles aren't strongly affected by sunlight, at least not in terms of their orbital properties. But there are other types of rings, which show up very nicely if you look back towards the sun on the dark side of the rings, like shown on slide 33, which there is this lovely image taken when Saturn was eclipsing the sun. The rings we're seeing more prominently here are made out of smaller particles, things smaller than a millimeter, and many of them, most of the ring particles are microns across, so equivalent to the width of a human hair. These particles have much bigger surface area to volume ratios, and so they're much more sensitive to non-gravitational forces, including just solar radiation pressure. Just the sunlight hitting them can actually change their orbits by a detectable amount. Now, the features in the rings that we've found are perturbed by sunlight most obviously are found in a couple gaps in the main ring system. They're located in slide 34. This shows a couple of images of the outer part of the main ring system. At the upper half, we have a typical view of Saturn's rings where I've highlighted the A ring, the B ring, and the Cassini division. And you can see there are several narrow gaps in the outer part of the A ring and many gaps in the Cassini division. Now, if you look at the dark side of the rings back towards the sun, you find these gaps aren't completely empty. They contain within them dusty ringlets that are made out mostly of these small particles. There are several ringlets in the Encke gap, which is marked, and there's also a ringlet in one of the gaps of the Cassini division, which we have chosen to name the Charming Ringlet, just to give it a name. I don't think that name is approved by anyone. We just use it informally to talk about it. The Charming Ringlet turns out to be quite interesting. As you can see on the next slide, slide 35, this shows a couple of images of the Cassini division, just two different images. And you can see the same series of gaps, and the white arrows point to the Charming Ringlet in this one large gap in the upper right-hand corner. Now, if you look, the image on the left, that ringlet is close to the inner edge of the gap. If you look on the right, the ringlet is close to the outer edge of the gap. Now, that is not because the position of the edges of the gap are moving much. Instead, it's actually the changing position of that ringlet. That ringlet seems to shift back and forth by a couple tens of kilometers, depending on when and where you look. And again, though, this isn't random. It does have a pattern. And it took us a while to find that pattern was, because it's not aligned with any moon. It's instead aligned with the sun. A cartoon representation of this ringlet is shown on slide 36 to show what I'm talking about. We have just an image of Saturn, its rings, and I've arranged it so the sun's off the top of the frame. Whenever we looked at this ringlet at points in the rings that were closest to the sun, we found it closer to the outer edge of the gap. Whenever we looked at this ring on the points at locations in the ring that were further from the sun, we found it was closer to the inner edge of the gap. So this yellow circle kind of shows, in a cartoony way, the orientation of this ringlet. Basically, the geometric center of that ringlet is displaced a little bit from the center of the Saturn towards the sun. We call this a heliotropic ringlet. It's like a sunflower. It points to the sun, and it does this consistently. Now, that's weird, but not unique. Turns out the Encke gap ringlets do a similar thing, which is shown on slide 37. We have a couple of images of the Encke gap and its corresponding ringlet, and that red line in both images marks a constant distance from the sun. In the upper image, the ringlet is a little above that line, and that image was taken at a point closer to the sun. In the lower image, the ringlet's a little below that line, which means the ringlet's a little closer to the center of Saturn, and that image is, again, taken further from the sun. So, again, this ringlet is also displaced in a way that seems systematic relative to the sun. Now, that strongly suggests that sunlight or something to do with the sun is affecting this ring. And it doesn't affect other rings. So we eventually were able to convince ourselves that what's going on is that it's actual sunlight. It's the sunlight hitting these ring particles, nudging them around on their orbits, is actually causing these ringlets to be displaced towards the sun. Well, if you have a hard time believing that sunlight could be affecting the ring particles, you probably even have a harder time believing that sunlight would drive a ringlet towards the sun. You might think it would blow it away from the sun. And that's perfectly reasonable. The complicating thing is that the particles in these ringlets aren't just moving through space. They're in orbit around a planet. And that complicates the situation in some important ways. Again, it's useful to consider cartoons. I just like cartoons. I think they make things clearer. If you look at slide 38, you will see a simple cartoon version of the planet and a ring particle in orbit around the planet. We're going to start this ring particle in orbit on a nice circular orbit marked by the dashed line, and we're going to imagine this particle is very small, so it's very sensitive to the sunlight, which is coming in from above. Now, we're going to start off with the particle heading away from the sun. Now, that means the sunlight's hitting it on its backside. That means it's basically going to nudge the particle forward in its orbit. It's going to act like a little bit of thrust. So the particle is going to actually get launched a little bit and be knocked out further from the planet. So as it goes around the planet, it's going to move a little further away from the planet, as shown by the curving arrow. Now, once, though, it gets to the other side of the planet, it's now heading towards the sun, as shown on slide 39. At that point, the sunlight's acting like a headwind. It's hitting the front side of the particle, and it's slowing it down. So as the particle now curves around the planet, it's going to fall in towards the planet. So what started out on a circular orbit is now on an orbit that ultimately gets closer and further from the center of the planet. It's now on an elliptical orbit. And as it keeps going around, that orbit's going to get stretched out more and more. Now, the other thing that comes into play once the particle's on an elliptical orbit is this fact that Saturn is slightly flattened, that Saturn has a slightly distorted gravitational field, which means that these elliptical orbits can't maintain a fixed orientation in space easily. They instead tend to clock around the planet at a well-defined speed. This is shown on slide 40. So as the orbit gets more and more stretched out, as it gets more and more elliptical, it also clocks around the planet in the same direction as shown on slide 40. Now, eventually, it clocks around so far that the particle gets as far from the planet as it ever gets. It gets to its maximum distance, not on the right side of the planet, as shown in this slide, but on the left side of the planet, as shown on slide 41. Now, at this point, the solar radiation pressure has the opposite effect on the particle's orbit. Now, instead of making the orbit more elliptical, it makes the orbit more circular. I mean, look in this case. The particle is again heading away from the planet, the particle is heading away from the sun, which means the sunlight's acting like a little bit of extra thrust. So as the particle goes around the planet, it's instead of following the dotted line, it's going to follow the curved solid line and be pushed a little further away from the planet. But what that means in this case is the difference between the maximum and minimum distance the particle is from the planet has become smaller. The orbit has become more circular. So as this particle goes around the planet, its orbit is being alternately stretched and squashed, and it's also clocking around the planet in a systematic way. Now, if you have a bunch of particles behaving in this way, you'll have a situation like you see on slide 42, where I have a couple of representative orbits shown in dashed lines, and just scattered a bunch of ring particles around them. And you have basically what's here, a ringlet that's displaced slightly towards the sun. Now, this isn't just a qualitative model that kind of sort of works. If you actually stick in the numbers, you find that given the intensity of sunlight at Saturn, and given particles of a reasonable size, like, say, 10 microns across, you can, in fact, produce shifts in the ringlets like we observe, which are of order tens of kilometers. So this pretty much holds together. Now, there's a couple of other situations where we also see non-gravitational forces perturbing the ring particles that are a little less obvious that I would like to talk about before we finish up. And these are found in other dusty rings, which are shown on slide 43. These are found in what are known as the D-ring and the Roche division. These are two dusty regions in Saturn's rings. They are located on either side of the main ring system. And if you look at these regions, you find interesting periodic structures. First go on to slide 44, which shows a map of the Roche division. We basically took this Roche division is basically the region that separates the A-ring from the F-ring. What we did is we basically looked at one part of this region in the rings and just sat there and watched material rotate through, taking a whole bunch of images. And then we took all that data and put it together to make a map of the brightness of the ring as a function of radius, distance from the planet, and time. Basically, this is what the brightness of the ring looked like at one particular longitude as a function of radius and time. Now, along the bottom, you can see this bright white band. That's the overexposed A-ring, and you can actually see the edge waving a little bit due to its resonance with Janus. In the upper right-hand corner, you have this bright blob that's associated with something in the F-ring. But in between, you see these diagonal bright and dark bands. They're most prominent around 137,500 kilometers, and they're very periodic. Now, the similar bright and dark bands are found in the D-ring, which is shown on slide 45, which shows a similar data set. And here you have more complex bright and dark patterns, but they have some similarities to those seen in the Roche division. Now, what's interesting about these patterns is that they don't move around the planet at the local orbital speed. They don't drift around the planet as you would expect if they were just clumps of material. They move at some different rate. this is like those patterns we see on the A ring edge and the B ring edge that track Mimas or Janus. That suggests these may be resonance structures. Basically, something is, you know, pushing the ring material in and out and causing it to, get clumped together in various ways. It's organizing the orbits as creating patterns that track some sort of periodic force. So this suggests there's some resonance involved, but there's no resonance with a known moon that would have the properties we need. But we don't necessarily need a moon. All we need is a periodic force. And for the moon-based resonances in the rings, the periodic force comes from the fact the moon is going around the planet. But any periodic force could potentially produce a resonance in the ring. So we now just want to ask, okay, well, what is the period of this force? Well, the period of the force is given by the period of the orbital period of these patterns, how fast these patterns rotate around the planet. Well, we did an analysis to try and figure out what that period was. The results are shown on slide 46. I couldn't get away without showing one graph. Which shows, basically, the trick was we found that there were multiple patterns that were moving at different speeds. So what we had to plot was basically the fraction of the pattern that was moving, that was rotating at a given period. And that's what we're showing here. The white data is for the D-ring. The purple data is for the Roche division. And both the D-ring and the Roche division show a peak at 10.8 hours. That means there's a very strong pattern that rotates around the planet once every 10.8 hours. In the D-ring, we see other peaks, including one that occurs at 10.5 to 10.6 hours. Now, these periods aren't close to the orbital periods of any particular moon, but they're very close to the rotation period of Saturn, which was interesting because that implied that maybe we're seeing a resonance here with something interior to Saturn. But we were confused because why are there two periods here? What's causing that? Well, we got a clue to what might actually be going on here when we started talking with some people who are looking at the radio emissions from Saturn, which are shown on slide 47. Turns out Saturn is a really good emitter of radio waves. And there is an instrument called the Radio and Plasma Wave Spectrometer that is designed to pick these up. And the data in the upper half of this image shows the intensity of the radio emissions as different colors as a function of the frequency of the emission and the time over the course of a few days. And I want to draw your attention to the thing marked the SKR. This is the Saturn kilometric radiation. This is just a particular type of radio emission that turns on and off about twice a day. This was seen by Voyager, and they thought, well, maybe this is the rotation period of the interior of the planet. Subsequent observations showed the frequency of this, show that the period of the SKR could change with time, which didn't make a lot of sense for something that was measuring the rotation state of the interior of the planet. And more recently, analysis of these data showed that there were actually two periodic signals within the SKR. Those two periodic signals are shown in the image on the lower left, which shows basically, again, in different colors, the intensity of periodic signals as a function of their period on the vertical axis and as a function of time along the horizontal axis, where we're now covering several years. There's something in this pattern which is called the first SKR component, which has a period of about 10.8 hours. There's another thing called the second SKR component, which has a period of about 10.5 to 10.6 hours. On slide 48, I just showed these are the exact same periods that we see in the D-ring. So, and we've done further analysis to support the idea that these two periods are very close to each other. This suggests that whatever is producing this periodic radio emission has some connection to a periodic force that's affecting the rings. That suggests that perhaps these rings are being pushed by electromagnetic forces. Remember, radio emissions occur because you have charged particles moving around. Now, the dusty rings, like the Roche, like the very small particles found in the D-ring and the Roche division, if those get a few electrons on them, or give a few electrons off, they have enough of a charge that they will actually can have their orbits significantly moved by non-gravitational forces, like basic various electric and magnetic fields in Saturn's magnetosphere. So it seems reasonable to suggest that both of these things, these features in the D-ring and these radio emissions, are somehow connected. But the physics is still very unclear at this point. And that's because these are come from very different parts of Saturn's magnetosphere. The radio emissions seem to come primarily from Saturn's poles, whereas the rings, of course, live in Saturn's equator plane. It's not clear what's connecting those two regions. But we're hoping as we study these two phenomena and understand how they track each other, we might get a better understanding of, you know, the electromagnetic forces surrounding Saturn. Okay, the last thing I just wanted to briefly mention is on slide 49. There are some features in Saturn's rings that may be produced by the gravity of other rings. In particular, there are these gaps in the Cassini division which are still resistant to explanation. And this is something I believe Dr. Cuzzi talked about at the previous Charm Telecon. I would be happy to talk more about this here, but I think since I've gone on for a little over an hour at this point, I think I'll just ask if there are any questions about any of the things I've talked about, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Matt. That was very interesting. Any questions out there for Matt?
Yep.
Okay.
Hello?
Go ahead. Hear some noises out there. Does somebody have a question?
Hello?
Yes.
Could I give a question?
Yep.
Okay. This is Nicholas from Copernic Observatory.
Hi.
I was wondering if you are able to simulate a lot of these things on computers and make predictions on all of these different resonances and periodic type events.
We can do that to an extent. There is a lot of work being done doing numerical simulations of ring material. A lot of work I've done has used uses just analytical calculations. Doing a full numerical simulation of a resonantly affected edge is a challenging problem because there are so many particles involved. When people try to simulate the rings, they usually try and simulate just a small patch of it to see how the particles interact. It's tricky to have all the scales involved. People have been able to do it, though, in a few cases. For example, there are some efforts to do some sorts of simulations of, say, the outer edge of the B ring and things like that, which, you know, people are really hoping to learn something out of. But a full-on simulation of, for example, a density wave is still, I think, a full numerical simulation of a density wave is still a bit beyond the computer capabilities at this point. I think you could make some one-dimensional, almost analogs of it, but not a full one yet.
What you do, are you doing those on the supercomputers at Cornell?
I personally do not do those sorts of simulations.
Oh, okay.
Simulations, sorry.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
This is Elizabeth Roslick from Berkeley County Planetarium in Hedgesville, West Virginia. And my question is, I'm assuming that this had nothing to do with it and Cassini hadn't seen very many of them, but back in the Voyager days, we had seen the spokes in the rings. And we had talked about them, well, they had talked about them as being tiny particles suspended in the due to friction up in the higher plane and casting a shadow on the rings. So I'm assuming they have nothing to do with resonance, since you didn't mention them, and since Cassini hasn't seen them. But, you know, I don't know if you know anything about it or if my assumption is wrong.
There is actually evidence for... Cassini has seen spokes now. It's been seeing them more intense. It didn't see them for the first couple years, but it's now seeing, it saw them fairly regularly for the last few. So we are seeing them. I didn't talk about them, not so much because they're not germane here, but there actually has been a charm telecon by Dr. Mitchell,
okay.
who who has actually talked about them, and it turns out they are made of small particles. And during the Voyager days, there was an analysis of how often the spokes appear and where they appear, and it seemed like that had a connection with the SKR period. Now, the new data, you know, the Cassini data, which, you know, is now being processed, I believe tends to show similar results, but whether it shows, for example, two periods and stuff like that, I don't think I can comment on that exactly at this point because I don't work directly on that particular aspect. But there may be resonances involved there as well.
Okay, thank you, and I will look up Dr. Mitchell's telecon on the web.
Right.
It's also published, I think, in Science or Nature as well, so there's a short, you know, four-page or so article that you can read about that.
Yep, there's a paper in Nature. I'm trying to remember whether Dr. Mitchell's thing is a little more recent than that. That was the only thing.
Yeah, very awesome. Any other questions for Matt?
Hi, Matt. This is Linda. A quick question. Do you want to say a little bit more about the Cassini division gap?
If you insist.
I think it's an intriguing story. So.
Okay. I'm happy to talk about that. If you go to slide 49, sorry, I'm getting a little echo now.
Yeah, can we have people star six? I'll do that myself to mute your phone because I think that works well for me.
Okay. I think that worked. Okay. So this is just a one slide thing. There is this, there in the Cassini division, which is what separates the A ring from the B ring, there's a series of eight narrow gaps. These gaps range from a couple hundred kilometers across to a couple tens of kilometers across. They're all named after astronomers now. They're called the Huygens, Herschel, Russell, Jeffries, Kuiper, Laplace, and Bessel, and Barnard gaps. It's always been a question why there are so many gaps in this one relatively narrow region of the rings. And before Cassini got there, there were some people who speculated, well, maybe there are small moons holding open these gaps, like, say, the Encke and Keeler gaps are held open by Daphnis and Pan. But to date, no one has claimed to have seen any moon in any of these gaps yet. Okay, so maybe they're held open by some sort of resonance. Well, you can go through and do the various moons and calculate where the resonances should be, and it turns out there are strong resonances near the inner edge of two of these gaps. The Huygens gap inner edge is also the outer edge of the B ring. So that one's strongly affected by the Mimas 2-1 resonance. The inner edge of the outermost gap is affected by a Mimas resonance with Prometheus. But that still left six gaps unaccounted for. So using various occultation measurements, not using images like this, we started looking at the shapes of these edges, the shapes of the edges of these gaps, and see if we can find any patterns. And what we found were that while the outer edges of these gaps tend to be rather circular, the inner edges tended to have shapes. They had simple one-lobe shapes. And they drifted around the planet very slowly, and that furthermore, the rates at which these patterns moved around the planet seemed to form a quasi-regular series, which suggested they may be part of a single series of resonances. But resonances with what? That wasn't clear. But what we found was, like I said, the B-ring edge, it's strongly affected, it has this pattern on it that tracks Mimas, but it also has other patterns on it, which are probably because, you know, Mimas is pushing the ring material in and out, but then that's causing material to collide amongst itself, and it's allowing for more complex structures to exist on the edge. Turns out if you compare the various speeds at which the patterns move around the B-ring edge, you can create the right speeds for all of these features, or at least some of the features, in this ring. So what we're suggesting, and what's still not entirely clear yet, is that perhaps these features in the Cassini division, these series of gaps, are produced by resonances, but not resonances with a moon directly. They're being produced by resonances with basically the edge of the B ring. The lumps on the edge of the B ring act like kind of nearby satellites, and their relative motion is creating a series of resonances. Now, will that play out when we've, you know, fully understood the system? We're not sure yet, but like Linda said, it's an intriguing idea that we hope to explore more in the future. Okay.
Any other questions for Matt?
This is Ann Schmidekamp from Penn State Abington. I have a question that's probably been answered before, but I wondered if you could explain again this very last slide you have where you say questions. You have that very famous picture of Saturn being eclipsed by the sun, as you said, and we have what I assume is the reflection of the rings off of the backside of Saturn. Can you explain a little bit more about what's actually happening there?
Well, okay, I'll first tell you at the beginning of this, it turns out I have given a previous charm telecon a couple of years ago called A New Perspective on Saturn's Rings or something like that, where I discuss what is going on in this image in inordinate detail. It is really fun. You have light from the rings hitting the planet. You have light from the planet hitting the rings. You have light hitting the rings, hitting the planet, being blocked by the rings. There's a lot of stuff going on there, and I think if you go to that presentation, it should actually answer most of your questions about that. I agree. It's a very strange-looking image.
Okay,
Is that an okay answer?
Yes. So it was a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I think it was in 2007, maybe.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions out there for Matt? Well, it sounds like not. We've gone on for an hour and a half, so maybe we'll bring it to a close. It's a great presentation. I really learned a lot from your cartoons and your graphics. I thought they were very instructive. So thanks for doing such a great job. And thanks for everyone for attending. Next month we're going to have a telecon. It's going to be Chris Peranikas from Applied Physics Laboratory, and he's going to talk about satellite magnetospheres interaction. So what happens to the satellites when they're floating around in Saturn's magnetosphere, how they get altered by the interaction with its magnetosphere. So it should be really interesting. I know sometimes the word magnetosphere makes people cringe and not dial in, but this should be a real interesting talk. So I hope you'll all attend. And with that, I'll bring the telecon to a close and say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Great presentation.
Thank you all.
Yes, thanks, Matt.
Thank you.